Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Thank you for downloading this podcast of Desert Island Discs from BBC Radio 4. For rights reasons, the music choices are shorter than in the radio broadcast. For more information about the programme, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4. My castaway this week is Hugh Laurie, actor, writer, director, musician. If life were straightforward, we'd be marooning him on our island because of his achievements as a championship rower. But his early promise on the water was scuppered by a bout of glandular fever, so he's had to make do instead with life as a worldwide entertainment superstar. Very British comedy, very big budget movies, very successful syndicated TV drama. His 30-year career has taken him from a little bit of Fry and Laurie to a big bit of broadcasting history. His role in the US show House ran for 8 series and had a global audience of 81 million. So why now does he feel the need to risk his stellar reputation by making music too? Well, he says, as soon as I acknowledge to myself that something is frightening and carries the risk of public humiliation, I feel like I have to do it. And there's the thing, you seem so far, Hugh Laurie, to have avoided any public humiliation. The music career going well, and the television career, especially across the pond, went extraordinarily well.
I suppose, yes. I mean, I've been very, very blessed. But I hear the beating of the wings behind me all the time. And I'm always anticipating disaster and, you know, feeling it brush by me.
You were working with a very brilliant team on House, of course, for all those years, especially very, very good writers. But to learn that 81 million people globally are watching what you're doing, destabilising, worrying, joy-making.
It's awfully hard to absorb, particularly because it's such a verbal, such a densely verbal, idiomatic, very, very funny, intricate show. I cannot imagine what it's like seeing it in Turkish. We had no car chases, no exploding helicopters or anything of that sort. And in fact, for that reason, I feel that my part quite rightly diminishes, because it is a triumph of the writers and the translators that the show was able to connect with people on such a scale.
30 years of work so far behind you. You first appeared on our screens in 1983 here in Britain. What bit of your work is the one that makes you most contented?
Wow. I think of and look at occasionally some things that I did with Stephen that we did on a bit of Fry and Laurie that I think of with great pride. I think there were moments in Blackadder. And I think particularly of the third series of Jeeves and Wooster, I think all the harmonics seem to be blending. But I can't look at anything I've done in the last month and think, oh, got that one right.
I do see, as you talk about those things further back in the past, genuine pleasure flitting across your face, which I'm happy about, because I think because of the press you get, I think, over the years, people have this idea that you're sort of, you know, this anhedonic character who kind of can't take pleasure in things.
Yes, and yes.
You don't seem very grumpy.
I'm not at all grumpy.
No.
And I have mistakenly allowed this picture to take hold. I am actually a fairly sunny individual. You know, particularly now, I walk around London, I think this is the most beautiful city in the world. And isn't Blossom splendid? I'm very easy to please and very, very happy. I have a spring in my step.
Your list of 8, given how important music is to you, and not just making music but listening to it, how did you go about choosing the list of 8 today?
These are just songs that have been friends of mine, as it were, for my whole adult life. And I also noticed that they're all old. I tend not to listen to music that was made a year ago. I don't know why that is.
Tell me about the first one then. What are we going to hear?
This is The Letter by Joe Cocker, a live version that he did at Fillmore in New York. Every time I hear it, I genuinely feel as if I am in the audience at one of the most spectacular and musically perfect performances ever.
That was Joe Cocker and the letter. I feel, Hugh Laurie, that we cheated you out of a bit of that. You were in a state of sort of superannuated bliss
I was in a state of bliss and am every single time. That's why I can be so confident about that as a first record, because I will never, ever, till the day I die, tire of that record.
People like Dominic West in The Wire and Damian Lewis now in Homeland, you know, we expect it, don't we? We expect all these great British actors to go across to America and make these wonderful award-winning programmes and performances. But when you did it, we didn't expect it. So tell me about auditioning. Was it 2004 when you auditioned for House?
2004, yes. I did a... first of all, I did a just put myself on videotape and sent it in.
Is it right you filmed that in the bathroom of a hotel?
In a bathroom in a hotel in Namibia, yes. So then I flew to Los Angeles and I auditioned in front of the Roman emperors. I mean, that's how it feels. It's sort of 30 television executives. By the time I actually read the full script, I thought, this could be something really, really exceptional. I mean, if you smell something good, you follow it.
You played a doctor, Greg House. What exactly was his job?
He was the head of diagnostic medicine. This is a remarkable notion, a remarkable character. More remarkable then than now, I think, in that up until that point, heroes in television drama had beautiful hair, lots of it, splendid teeth and fine jawlines, and to find something so jagged, so to find such a misfit, such a misanthrope, such a tortured, dark, sarcastic character at the centre of a drama was then very unusual. It's now...
It's required.
It's required.
That. And famously, it was the case that they thought you were American. Is that right? I mean, I've read that so many times, I can't believe it's true.
I don't. I can't believe it either. Bryan Singer, who directed the pilot, when he saw the tape that I made, he apparently did believe that I was American. What a tin ear he must have.
You mentioned, you know, the cragginess, not having to have the perfect jawline or the perfect American set of teeth or the perfect hair. Did they ever try to change you a little bit?
They did start adjusting my hair. Actually, I colluded in this because, to begin with, when I started, I was a young man, I was sort of slightly, faintly, suggestively balding.
Right.
And you don't want that moment when I turn away from the camera, the only impression of that moment to be, oh, he's going bald. This should be, oh, the patient's going to die, not, oh, that man's going bald. What a rod for my own back.
Right.
Because it then became fighting natural decay.
So what was it, a weave or something?
They would pour sort of head pepper, a sort of jar of matter, to my head and then stick it there.
You see, now I'm looking at your hair. You haven't got it on today, have you? You don't use it.
I don't use it. No. I'm proudly bald.
I don't know how we got here, but
no,
we are
no,
going
no.
to
let's reverse out of this alleyway.
Let's have some beautiful music. Tell me about your second disc. What have you chosen?
This is a song by Sister Rosetta Tharpe, My Journey to the Sky. I can never hear Sister Rosetta's voice and not be thrilled to my boots. I'm not a religious person, but whenever I'm listening to her, I sort of become religious.
There's only one thing that I long for when I reach that heavenly land, to see my Jesus and his glory.
Sister Rosetta Tharpe and My Journey to the Sky. Let's look back for a moment, Hugh Laurie, to your parents. Your father sounds like a wonderful man. He achieved a lot in his life and you didn't know about much of it until you were in your teens. He won a gold medal at rowing at the Olympics.
He did.
And he didn't tell you.
In 1948, he did not tell me. Or anybody else, actually. He was an excessively modest and self-effacing man.
How did you learn that he'd won a gold medal at the Olympics?
I went fishing with him. I was probably about 10, and we got into a boat, set out onto this lake to go fishing. And my father took the oars, and I can remember whispering to my mother, does Dad know how to row? And she said, yes, he does. He does know how to row. In fact, he used to keep his gold medal in a sock drawer. It was not proudly displayed. I mean, he had great pride in it. He was just the sort of man he was. And I think perhaps it was a generational thing as well. they'd been through a lot, after all. They'd been through a war and things like medals and all the baubles of success they didn't particularly pay attention to.
And your mother, tell me about her.
She was she could be tremendously funny at certain times. She could also rather gloomy. I think in as much as I am ever prey to being gloomy, I think I probably got that from her. I think she could be she could be gloomy.
Did you navigate around her when she was in those moods? Did you know to steer clear? Or?
Yes, I did. I competed is the wrong word, but we could both sulk. I learned how to sulk. And I'm happy to say that I think I have finally reached a point in my life where I've dispensed with that skill.
Did you think she didn't like you?
I felt that I was a disappointment sometimes, yes, I did. Well, I didn't like me, actually.
Yes, but that's normal. But to feel your mother doesn't like you is not quite so normal.
Maybe not. I think it's because she, for whatever reason, she had high expectations, with a capital H. And maybe when I didn't live up to those frequently, in fact, wait a minute, always.
By doing what?
Well, I suppose academically, maybe. I didn't apply myself. Maybe she thought I was frivolous. What may have been at the root of it is that I had not been through what she had been through, such as fighting a war.
Yes.
And going without. So the privation. And I don't blame her for that.
So the sort of subtext to her parenting was, you have been served all this privilege and calm on a plate. The least you can do is excel.
The least you can do is excel or torture yourself with how much privilege you have been given. They'd spent 15 years in living in Africa, and they had seen and knew well what a crust of bread meant. And the waste of any kind was anathema. And I have that, I can't bear things to be wasted. I can't even bear to see it actually in fictional representations. I can't bear to see people breaking things or crashing cars in films. I go, oh, don't crash. Oh, you could have pretended to crash. Don't. Someone could have used that.
We'll have some more music, Hugh Laurie. Your third of the morning. What are we going to hear?
This is a tune by Randy Newman, Louisiana 1927. I've always loved this song. But it came back into everybody's consciousness, obviously, after Hurricane Katrina. And this is a song about the terrible flood of 1927. And I find it just so beautiful and stirring.
What has happened down here is the wind air change. Clouds roll in from the north and it start to rain. Rained real hard to rain. For a real long time, 6 feet of water in the streets of Evangeline. River rose all day, the river rose all night.
That was Randy Newman and Louisiana 1927. I'm wondering, Hugh Laurie, when you talk about the humility that was expected and practiced within your family, the sort of Presbyterian ethic. As a winner of 2 Golden Globes, 2 Screen Actors Guild Awards, 4 People's Choice Awards and an OBE, how are you with accepting praise? Do they all sit easily on your shoulders?
I should point out, I'm not wearing them on my shoulders at this moment, but although there are some days.
It was a poor choice of words, but you know what I mean.
Not completely. I mean, I feel that there's probably some mistake. I'll find some possible explanation that will at least sort of nurture that doubt, which I think, I mean, doubt is good. I think fear is good. I certainly think all performers should be frightened. I think you have to be frightened of what you're doing, otherwise it probably isn't worth doing.
I read somewhere that there was a point in your life when you stopped feeling fearful. You know, you would be doing dangerous things and you were just sort of flat. Your mood was flat and that worried you.
I was in the middle of a stock car race. I don't remember the circumstances, but I do remember cars either side of me were exploding. I mean, literally balls of fire. And I was sort of weaving my way through this. And I remember being bored, actually, neither frightened nor exhilarated. And I thought, that can't be right. So I started to investigate that a little bit.
What did you find out?
Well, oddly enough, if you ask a psychiatrist or a psychotherapist whether you might be suffering from depression, oddly enough, they're inclined to say yes. If by saying yes, they encourage you to come back and give them 55 quid for an hour's consultation. Yes. Yes is the answer you'll get.
Right. I don't in any way want to sort of agitate the possibility that you might have an episode of mild depression, but I do want to talk to you about the Oxford and Cambridge boat race, which I understand still in your mind's eye is something that you sort of replay. Tell me about your part in that and tell me what happened.
It is, but this is the most childish thing. I still don't want to give my opposite number in the other boat the satisfaction of knowing that I lose sleep over it. Right. I'm still that competitive. We lost, I think, by the narrowest margin possibly ever, but we lost by 5 feet after 4.25 miles.
And to be clear, you were in the Cambridge boat.
I was in the Cambridge. I was in the losing boat, yes.
Let's have some more music, Hugh Laurie. What are we going to hear next?
This is Grinning in Your Face by Sun House, which is a bleak but absolutely haunting piece of music. Sun House was a preacher who turned away from the church and he went over to the blues side, the worldly side of music. And this is just his voice and his hand claps, and I'm not even quite sure what it is that he's clapping to. He's hearing something in his head, and I feel as if I hear it too, and I'm absolutely thrilled by this piece of music always.
Don't you mind people grinning in your face? Don't mind people grinning in your face. Yeah, just bear this in mind. A true friend is hard to find. Don't you mind people grinning in your face. You know they grin in your face.
That was Sun House and Grinning in Your Face. It should be said, Hugh Laurie, you were somewhere else when you were listening to that, and I was wondering where you were.
Yes,
you were somewhere far away there.
I was far away.
I can actually, it doesn't show up particularly well on radio, but I actually do have goosebumps on my, which that's something, that's an effect I have experienced ever since I first heard that record. I mean, it might be about the actual words that he's singing. A true friend is hard to find. Or it may be something that is even more basic than that. It is just those notes. Those notes just do a thing to my body that is absolutely transporting.
Let's muse for a moment then on the importance of friendship. At Cambridge, you made friends, and as far as I understand it, they are still close and good friends of yours, especially Mr. Fry. When you first met Stephen Fry, did you automatically become quick, firm friends?
It was pretty instantaneous. I mean, luckily for us, being English, it was concealed by the need to actually do something. We agreed that we were going to do this show and we had to start writing there and then. We made each other laugh. We played chess until the sun came up and we barely had a crossword. I think we might have had three. One of them was of. I cannot remember what the other two are. That's actually not really natural, is it, not to have a crossword? That seems odd.
And Emma Thompson also was part of that Footlights group. It was the first one to win the inaugural, as it was then, Perrier Comedy Award up at Edinburgh. And she said that she looked at you, this great big sort of hunky rower, and thought, yes, star, star, star.
Wow. I don't know how to respond to that.
What did you do that made people laugh? Can you remember the first big laugh you got on stage?
It was something foolish. It was playing a moron. I just seem to have a face that lends itself to idiocy, and I think I probably exploited that. I think I probably wrung everything I could out of it.
As well as performing, of course, you were writing at the same time. Did that writing come easily to you? You had a facility for it.
There were days when it went well, particularly when writing with Stephen. You know, there were days when things would just sort of flop out onto the page in an incredibly pleasing way, just like landing a big gleaming salmon, which, by the way, I've never done, but I imagine would be a very satisfying thing. You know, we would make each other laugh and the laughter would provoke the next idea and the next idea and the next idea. And all of a sudden, and sometimes in a matter of minutes, you would have something that you knew was a genuinely good and interesting and funny piece of work that we could actually present to the public without shame.
Let's have some more music. Tell me about what's next.
In honour of my great friendship with the writer and broadcaster, Stephen Fry, this is a song by Professor Longhair called Go to the Mardi Gras, and it's something that we actually used for the very first television show we ever did together as the title music. But that's sort of by the by. I also happen to love this. It makes me just so happy. This would get me through some grim days on a desert island, I've no doubt, because it just makes me so happy to hear this.
While you're going and you're lean, you ought to go see the Mardi Gras. If you go to New Orleans, you ought to go see the Mardi Gras. When you see the Mardi Gras, somebody'll tell you what's carnival for. Get your ticket in your hand, you wanna go to New Orleans.
That's Professor Long here, and go to the Mardi Gras. There are few, actually very few people, only a handful of people that have to deal, and I think it is a case of having to deal with the sort of fame you have. Living in LA, day to day, what are the things you would do?
There are things I don't do and places I can't go to. Someone asked me if I'd, you know, you've lived in California all that time, didn't you ever go surfing? No, I didn't go surfing, because you cannot surf. You're not allowed that sort of tentative first experience of anything without being on the, you know, having your picture taken. And so you can't do it unless you're going to surf in the dark, which I believe is not to be recommended.
You've made that deal with yourself then, but when it comes to the family, that's a more complex thing to reason out, isn't it? Because if your son does want to play ball with you on the sand and there are other people watching and they're going to take your picture and you know it's going to be in the tabloids, and it inhibits you.
It does, yes, but... I suppose I knew all that when I started. Well, actually, I didn't know all of that because no. Digital cameras did not exist when I signed up. For example, I heard the other day that there have been more photographs taken in the last 12 months than have ever been taken in the world, ever, because people are now photographing, I shudder to think what they are photographing, everything and nothing. No interaction is deemed to have actually happened unless somebody has a picture of it. Nobody is satisfied with having met a person without having a photograph to prove it. I think that is odd, and I think it's so odd that it might actually be starting to alter the way we think about each other and the way we think about sort of general day-to-day social interaction.
House is finished now, and you are back, as far as I understand it, living in Britain. Do you notice a difference in how people treat you here? You're not just that funny man off the telly anymore.
No, I was never really aware of... Well, I suppose maybe I was aware of that. You know, Blackadder, I know, was a thing that you know, really did connect with people. I was immensely proud of that. House was not such a big thing here. I mean, relative to other countries, I became a very big cheese in France and Italy and Germany. But less so here, which I also understand, because this was a country where people would probably find it harder to believe in, because they knew that I was the Burke from Blackadder or something. It would be just harder to buy it as a premise.
Let's have some music. What are we going to hear now?
We are going to hear a wonderful tune. This is a recording by Nina Simone. I Wish I Knew... well, it's actually I Wish I Knew, brackets, How It Would Feel to Be Free, brackets. It's a sort of musically perfect thing that could... For me, it could just go on for hours and hours and hours. I never, ever want this to stop.
I wish I could share all the love that's in my heart. Remove all the bars that keep us apart. I wish you could know what it means to be me. Then you'd see.
That was Nina Simone, and I Wish I Knew How It Would Be to Be Free. I wonder, Hugh Laurie, why you've gone public with your music. I mean, you can play and you can sing, but a man of your means could have just made the album, given it to his friends, and not faced any of the heartache of wondering if the record-buying public was going to like it.
I am wondering the same thing myself.
You could have just given it to your friends for Christmas.
I could have. What am I thinking?
The first album went to number two. You have recently released your second album. Does it matter to you that the public likes it?
Yes, it does. You know, and I'm proud of it, and I would like people to hear it. I suppose one of the sort of incidental explanations is that because a record company came and said we're prepared to do this and we'll put ourselves behind it, I got to play with the most wonderful musicians in the world. I mean,
Do you feel up to them? I mean, do you feel much fit?
Not at all.
Right.
But I, from their point of view, I hope that I bring something else besides whiskey.
You've always played piano since you were a little boy.
Yeah. The piano is my constant companion.
Didn't you, when you were a kid, give up? I mean, you really chucked in your piano lessons and went on hunger strike.
Especially in piano lessons, I hated the way music was taught. And I must say that many, many years later, when my own children started piano lessons and I started investigating, you know, the Royal College of Music's sort of instructional audio tapes, you know, I was thinking, blimey, this has not changed at all. This is pretty dry stuff.
What do your three kids make of you making music? Is that highly embarrassing to them?
It's probably mortifying. They're a pretty tolerant bunch, though, and there are certain things they'll give it a sort of nod. No, that one's all right. You know, no, don't do that. And when I play on stage, I'm afraid to say, and this is every child's nightmare, I do occasionally dance. And no child should have to witness their parents dancing.
And you used to play with your kids, didn't you? You all played together. They're musical, too.
We went by the name the Von Krapp family, and we were available for weddings and bar mitzvahs. And I love hearing my children play. It's probably the greatest pleasure I can think of, in fact, is hearing them play the piano.
Let's have some music now. What are we going to hear next?
We are going to hear possibly the greatest assembly of musicians gathered under one name, one banner. This is the Lester Young Trio. But it's Buddy Rich, Nat King Cole and Lester Young Trio playing I Cover the Waterfront.
Enjoy.
Extraordinary place.
That was Buddy Rich, Nat King Cole and the Lester Young Trio and I Cover the Waterfront. For all of those very many millions of fans, Hugh Laurie, who lust after a bit more of Fry and Laurie, would you ever think about recapturing the partnership?
Oh, absolutely. We do. We talk about it all the time. We talk about it often. I think probably sketching is a young man's game, because by and large it's about mocking people much older than you. We're not only the age of cabinet ministers, we're actually probably older than half the cabinet.
If it wasn't sketches, then what do you think you might do with Stephen Fry?
A sort of Flanders and Swan type review, I think, a stage review with a couple of wing chairs and a rug and a decanter of Madeira. And my colleague will recount amusing stories, and I will sit at the piano and play ditties. I know no more than that. We have not advanced with this idea, but that would be my pick for the way to go.
A promoter is picking up the phone as we record this very programme. You are heroically self-effacing, but I'm wondering if in a tiny little hidden part of yourself you do now accept that you are a great actor.
No, I don't. I think I've learned a thing or two, and I think I know a good thing when I see it. I mean, I'm fascinated by acting. I'm fascinated by behaviour. I'm fascinated by people, and there are things I would love to capture and explore. And in any guise, actually, as a writer or director, as much as an actor, I find the whole process of it fascinating. But I absolutely don't. I mean, I was just so lucky to find a thing that fitted. And my collaboration with the creator of the show, David Shaw, I'm not saying we didn't pat each other on the back exactly, but we did quite often say, boy, we were very lucky to have found each other.
Given that you were brought up in a family where you didn't find out for a good long time that your father had won a gold at the Olympics, were your parents able to take pride in your achievements?
I do have a memory of winning a prize at school when I was probably 8 or 9. There was a school drama prize. I think every class had to do a 10-minute thing. And I won the prize. My parents were late. They missed it. But that was not uncommon. So they missed what I did, but they were there when my name was read out at the winner of this year's acting prize. And I do remember a moment of real pleasure and pride on their faces. I was sort of peeking through the curtain to see whether they'd arrived. And I could, just as my name was read out, I saw this big beaming smile on my parents' faces. And that was a great thing. That will never leave me, I must say. And I think my father, as a doctor, I think would have enjoyed a very different kind of doctor to House. He's absolutely didn't share any of his characteristics, but I think he would have enjoyed the rationality of it.
It's time for your final piece of music then, Hugh Laurie. What are we going to hear?
We are going to hear a song by Van Morrison. This song is called Brown Eyed Girl. There is a brown eyed girl in my life, and I'm lucky enough to be married to her. And this is a song that will forever summon up my my life with my wife, Jo.
Hey, where did we go? Days when the rains came. Down in the hollow, playing a new game. Laughing and running, hey, hey. Skipping and jumping. In the misty morning fog with all our hearts thumping and you. A brown-eyed girl. You, my brown-eyed girl.
That was Van Morrison and Brown-Eyed Girl. So I'm going to give you some books now. You get to take the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare to the island, and one of your own books too. What would you like to take along?
I would like to, am I allowed to take an encyclopedia?
Yes.
It's simply that I find myself with less and less interest in fiction as the years go by. I don't know why that is, and I think probably an encyclopedia probably gives me the most consistent pleasure that I get from reading now, is delving into strange and unlikely areas about which I know nothing.
Right, that's yours then. And a luxury?
A set of throwing knives. Not just three. If I can have a double set, because otherwise you throw three and then you've got to go and get them.
Right.
So if I could throw six before I have to go and get them, that would be terrific. I would like to return from the island with an uncanny skill. To be able to knock the pip out of an ace of spades at 20 paces, that would be a great thing.
They're yours, those two sets.
Thank
and
you.
If you had to save just one track from the waves, which one would it be?
I will obviously be in terrible trouble if Brown Eyed Girl isn't it, and luckily Brown Eyed Girl would be it.
Hugh Laurie, thank you very much for letting us hear your desert island discs.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a download from the BBC. You'll find more information on the Radio 4 website. bbc.co.uk/radio4